This is Ken Paulson from Americana Music News, and today we are delighted to talk to Webb Wilder, and he's got a brand new record, a brand new old record, I suppose, called Powerful Stuff. Webb, welcome.
Thanks, Ken. Yeah, it's a new album of old recordings.
And they were unearthed from some cave somewhere?
In a manner of speaking, and let me add that they were all previously unreleased, so it is not really a rehash, but yeah, they were in a 21st century cave, a storage unit.
Really, literally.
Yeah.
And we're all fortunate, I think, that it never ended up being auctioned off, the contents of a storage unit, which apparently is a very big business in America today.
Yeah. I mean, I guess it's a big business in the television world, and it's a big business in the business world.
Well, the folks who are listening to this are largely fans of Americana music, and you certainly qualify for what Americana music has evolved into. But in a lot of ways, Webb Wilder in Nashville in the 80s, you were one of the godfathers of what we now know as Americana music. When you got to Nashville, what was the scene like, and what were you hoping to do in that scene?
On one hand, there were some really exciting things beginning to bubble. And on the other hand, the larger scene was dominated by a not particularly great period, but money-making machine period of the mainstream country music industry. It was unbelievable how square and conservative they were, while at the same time not being very country, you know? And anybody that was a good musician or a good writer was trying to ply their trade in that world and compromising their integrity usually in the process. And there was so it was very hard to get anybody to commit to being in a band. But, you know, you had bright spots all throughout it. You had the great, you know, undercurrent legacy of people like Johnny Cash, you know, who were still here and active. And it is a song town, and it is a songwriter's town, so even if they made a bad record out of it, there were always great songs. But then you had Jason and the Scorchers beginning to get lift off. My favorite band, which is more of what in England would have been called a pub rock band, Tim Creckle and the Sluggers. And Tim had some success writing songs for other people, and Jason did one of his songs. You had Steve Earle really just starting out, although he'd been around a while, and he'd hung out with Rodney and Towns and all those people, and he'd even played bass. I can't imagine that, but he'd played bass with Guy Clark. So I met Steve, I met Jason, I met Tim, and the White Animals were a very popular party band. What's funny is that I met my goals really quickly and realized I should have set them higher. I just wanted to kind of have like a roots rock sort of band that was based out of here and could get an indie deal and play music. You know,
and you got all those things
and went past that, and we got major label deals,
right?
You know, yeah.
So I know you're the last of the full grown men. Do you have like a trademark on that, by the way?
I don't, but I got stories about that. But
I think you have some copyright protection, I'm pretty sure.
Usage,
yeah, there you go. But having said that, you were never the youngest of the full grown men, in other words,
no.
You did not pop out of the womb as Webb Wilder.
No, I sort of tried not to be that guy, you know. It's funny because Mississippi is almost where everything came from, you know. And, I mean, it's such an amazing Afro-Celtic cauldron of culture that has produced so much great music, yet the squares are always running the show down there, and they're keeping it down, and everybody has to leave. And so it's like nobody I knew anybody much who'd ever done anything in the larger world of music until I met Dan Tyler, really. But then the irony in that is I found out after I'd already started playing in garage bands in high school, and I began to find out more of the story later, that my own aunt and uncle had become iconic figures in the blues and roots music world long before I was born, because they had Trumpet Records and recorded Elmore James and Sonny Boy Williamson.
Wow.
Yeah.
For those who don't know Dan Tyler, you met him in Mississippi?
Yes, through my Aunt Lillian, who had Trumpet Records. And what happened was we had this band called the Drapes. And and I'll see the lead guitarist, Casper Rawls, this weekend in Hattiesburg. And we were pretty good, and we had a bunch of different people who could sing. And that's one reason we were good. We had versatility. And we'd play Jackson, where she lived a lot. And Dan's wife, Adele, is from Jackson. And Dan had had some songwriting success and was living here, but he might have been still practicing law, too, which he hasn't done in a long time now. But anyway, she said, you should go hear my nephew's band. And being a songwriter, he wanted to know who was doing the bulk of the writing, and it was Bobby Field, who I'd known since I was 14. You know, his mother was my first Sunday school teacher. And a lot of that band and a lot of the Webb Wilder and the Beatniks, you know, stuff was the concepts and the songs, and a lot of the stuff came from his unbelievable mind, you know.
Do you remember the first time you stepped on stage as Webb Wilder?
Yes, I do. Yes, I do. It was at the Sutler. It was either at the Sutler or this club that used to be in Lion's Head Village on White Ridge Road called Bogies. Both those gigs were in March of 1985, and I always forget which one came first. But, you know, we go so far back with the Sutler that when they reopened it and they named all these people who had played there, they didn't go back to our period. They didn't go back that far enough.
Well, I understand that the Webb Wilder persona came actually from a movie project.
Yeah, and once again, Bobby Field had a lot to do with it. He and I had played in some bands in Hattiesburg, and I had come up here for two semesters to go to Peabody College, and I had kind of fallen in love with Nashville in 1974. And he had a great band in Mississippi called The Howlers, and very versatile. Closest thing you could think of like them would be maybe like Commander Cody and the Lost Planet Airmen. And we'd been hearing a lot about Austin. And he came up here and he didn't really dig it. And it was pretty tightly controlled by Squares at the time, despite all the great musicians, the great writers, etc. So I had wrapped up my tenure as a student here and was going back down there. And we decided to go to Austin to check it out in the summer of 75. And well, by the January of 76, I had put together a band and moved out there. And by the spring, the Howlers had moved out there. And then a couple of years into it, they broke up and it became Omar and the Howlers. And of course, we all know Omar and the Howlers, yeah.
That's great. So the first time I saw you, I was like knocked on my heels. And I couldn't help but sort of hear Dave Edmunds, Nick Lowe, some pub rock stuff, which normally you wouldn't get coming out of Mississippi. I just, you know, maybe variants on that. If you had a Mount Rushmore of your influences, who would be on it?
You know, it's tough because anybody you ever liked who you could even get next to the style of the way they sang or played would deserve to be on it. The Dave Edmunds monkey beat, racka racka, whatever that rhythm, that, and I guess a lot of times it was Dave and a lot of times it was Billy Bremner, but their way they play the Chuck Berry rhythm is kind of my default setting. So, you know, in a way you'd have to put Dave Edmunds up there. But Ronnie Wood is a big guy for me. I don't know of anyone who's a bigger Faces fan than me. Dan Baird and I may be tied. And I got to know Ian McLagan and be friends with him. Dan and the Satellites got to record with him, which was always a dream of mine that sadly, now that he's passed, will never happen. But Ronnie Wood, you know, was a bass player and a guitar player, and I had started out playing bass, and he was a rhythm lead guy, and I'm sort of there. Singers, you know, I had a lower voice than most of the singers I liked, but I still picked up stuff from their phrasing and their joie de vivre or whatever. So one of the pluses of being someone who can't sing or play just like the record, and, you know, like some of these great cover band guys, is you sort of have to find your own style. And like I saw Omar not long ago, and he was complimenting me on some stuff, and he said, you found your way to do it. And I was like, yeah, I had no other choice. You
know? So the album's out there right now, and of course the album title is Powerful Stuff. And that title cut is going to be what's most familiar to folks who first sit down with the CD, because it was a big hit for the Fabulous Thunderbirds. And I want to play a little bit of that and then get back to you and hear how it is that you didn't have the top 10 record.
Not a high skirt, black stack heels, red copper hip, dig a wig and something real. Shout now. Old man Alex, holding up the world. Each copper ever pain, but that girl showed love. I think I'm in love.
Great version, Webb. How in the world did that not lead off your greatest hits album?
Well, the way I recall, here's what happened. So Bobby Field was so close to the band. He had left the band as the drummer, but he was still writing and producing. And so we would hear all his songs first. But he was co-writing with other people and us. And he was on a roll, you know, and he had a publishing deal and all that. So we knew Mike Henderson. We knew Wally Wilson. And the three of them, Bobby, Wally, and Mike, wrote that song. But immediately, Bobby, who is a great arranger, too, he brought us the song and that arrangement.
Wow.
And we worked it up. We started playing it. We thought, well, this is cool. It'll probably be on our next album. But then you had three sets of publishers working the song. So the next thing you know, it's out of our hands, sort of. And Wally told me there's even a version by Motley Crue that's never come out. How about that?
I'm not sure if that's a good thing or a bad thing.
And I've been a fan of the Fabulous Thunderbirds since before they had records. I remember meeting Jimmy Vaughn in the 70s, you know, and a big fan. And so, in a way, I liked it that they got a hold of it rather than Motley Crue, whatever. So the T-Birds recorded it, and it was on the Cocktail soundtrack. Now, Cocktail was a huge movie, and the soundtrack was huge as a Tom Cruise movie. You know, he hasn't had any duds in terms of success. So we thought, and then it's on the radio, and it's a hit. We said, we can't do that. People won't know that we're maybe the first band to ever play it. They'll think we're a cheesy cover band, you know. So we just shelved it, and I hadn't really thought about it in years. And this project came up, and we found this live recording we had done at Mountain Stage that I didn't really realize we had. And so then Michael Rothschild, who I love to death at Landslide, the label, wanted to put it on the album. And I thought, well, that's cool. And then he wanted to call the album that. And it kind of became like a deal breaker. He was very insistent on calling it that. I never wanted to call it that because the T-Birds had already called an album that. They'd already had the hit. And there's so much else on here. Like there's a version of Lost in the Shuffle that's so different than the Acres of Suede version that has horns. And I thought, that's the interview, that's the title, that's the story, Lost in the Shuffle. These recordings have been lost in the shuffle for years, and here they are now. No, he wouldn't have it. So that's what I know about that.
Well, let's take that as a cue. This Lost in the Shuffle should have been the title cut. Let's hear it now. Stuff, Webb.
Thanks.
I'm intrigued by the sheer longevity and energy around your career. You know, you talked about attaining exactly what you set out to do, but then the other thing you have done that a lot of other people never accomplish is to have that art run through your life. And it's, mm-hmm. There's not a point when you're Bobby Field and say, I don't want to get on a bandstand again.
Well, it could still happen.
But you clearly love what you do, and you've got a probably a larger than cult-like following. There is certainly a Webb Wilder crowd. Where are you biggest? What geographic region?
Well, probably, in all honesty, probably the Midwest. And it has a lot to do with the way the Midwest has always supported live music and Southern music. You know, think about all the Mississippi bluesmen who went to Chicago. And we always did well in Chicago, and we continue to play there. And early on, through the indie and major deals, you know, we had a lot of airplay on WXRT. France was the country in Europe that took to our thing the best. We sold on an unbelievable number. I'd really like to know the number of vinyl recordings of It Came From Nashville there many years ago. Sadly, you know, not as big in my hometown. I've really proved that you can never make it in your hometown thing. I'm not going to be like Janis Joplin, though, and go back and get on film drunk and cry about it. But yeah.
So being Webb Wilder, there's a certain Clark Kent Superman thing here. And Superman has to come out and wear yellow, red, blue. He's got to have a cape.
Yeah.
Can never, ever wear glasses while he's Superman. To any extent, does sort of the outrageous persona of Webb Wilder limit what you do musically?
Well, it probably should from a marketing point of view, but due to my eclectic tastes and stubbornness on doing everything from, you know, tender ballads to novelty songs, it hasn't. It may have impeded the success, though. You know, when you and I grew up, you know, the Beatles gave everyone this license that everyone didn't choose to legitimize or whatever that I did, that you can do anything on one album, you know, because they would do a Broadway show tune and a Chuck Berry song and write something and let Ringo sing a country song. To me, that's what makes a good album. Now, there are good albums that are one way, and you're blessed if you're a guy like Johnny Cash who has a sound, and you always know. But so I think there are people who would like me to be that one novelty song, poolside, human cannonball, joke-cracking guy. But, man, I just love all kind of stuff. And having said that, it's still a fairly narrow margin. It doesn't go into opera or classical [S2] Right. [S1] Music or even jazz. I just like the whole country, folk, rock and roll, rhythm and blues, Chicago blues, country blues. You know, not such a bluegrass guy, but I loved the way Lester Flatt sang, you know. So I always tell people I'll be at the table, the merchandise table at the gig, and they'll say, well, which one should I buy? And I'll say this or that one, and I'll say, get this one, because I guarantee if you don't like one song, the next one will be very different.
Huh. You know, just thinking aloud when you're talking about the Beatles and how they had that courage. The one commonality, though, to all those records is that every song was well written.
Good stuff.
You know, like Till There Was You, it sounds kind of out of place, and you're thinking maybe McCartney's pandering to the adult audience, and he probably was.
It worked for me, though. I loved
it. But it was a great song.
It probably indirectly led them to Fool on the Hill.
Well, there you go. And the country covers they had, you know, Act Naturally, they were all really well-written songs, and maybe that's, everyone should be aspiring to that. It's not about a sound, it's about the quality of the material you record.
Well, you know, they were great fans and great listeners. And, you know, when people, you know, we all know about those artists who write all their own stuff and you wish they wouldn't. And I always want to tell them, you know, you've heard of this band, the Beatles, these guys, John and Paul, really good writers. They did some covers. You know, they did Carl Perkins, they did Chuck Berry, they did Larry Williams, and they did Buck Owens, you know. And they wrote great songs, and they did them all. And that's kind of been my modus operandi. And I've not written as many songs as I would like. But on the other hand, I feel pretty good about the songs I've recorded, you know.
So as you dug through the tapes, and something I really wondered, when you tell me it's in a storage unit, I'm about to hear it, and I'm thinking, well, this is going to be like the Beatles in Hamburg, right?
Yeah, yeah.
The worst possible fidelity. But these sound really good. How did you do that?
Well, giving credit where credit's due, a lot of it had to do with George Bradfute, who isn't known as the tone chaperone for nothing. But, you know, they were captured well and performed well, and they were on two, for the most part. Now, there's a couple of, some of the live stuff was 24-track high-fidelity recording, but there's a couple of live things that were really lo-fi, and we did what we could with them. But the good fidelity stuff, which makes up 8/10 of the album, is there were 2-inch analog tapes. We baked them, we transferred them, we dumped them into Nuendo. George doesn't like Pro Tools for whatever reason, and got some really good mixes. And you know, there were a couple of instances where there might be kind of an 80s sounding thing on the original mix that we were, you know, we were able to take it down to and what the car guys would call a ground up restoration.
So when you dug through the tapes and heard these long-lost tracks, which one was a revelation? You'd forgotten you'd done, and you were just knocked out by your own performance.
Well, there were some revelations. I think one revelation was I didn't remember doing that version of Lost in the Shuffle. And it's got horns, and I play some lead guitar on it that I'd kind of forgotten about, and it made me remember the guitar, which I sadly sold, you know. And I'd forgotten about that version of No Great Shakes. That has the prototypical lyrics that are different than what we think of as the one. And but what has come off as the freshest one to me was a song that my fans had never heard because it had never been out there. I wrote it with Terry Anderson. It's this song called New Day. And I wish I'd been not so close to the project. It's 5 minutes and 41 seconds long. We might should have edited it. But it's a bona fide rock song, you know, and people like it. We've got some good feedback on it.
Well, let's go out here with a bona fide rock song. The new album is called Powerful Stuff, Webb Wilder and the Beatniks. It's a generous collection of 16 songs. It culminates with Little Richard, and highly recommended. Let's close out with No Great Shakes. No Great Shakes and Powerful Stuff. Great to see you, Webb.
Thank you, Ken. It's great to be here, and it's always a gas. Thanks a lot.
Next up is First Person. Today we'll hear from Cheryl Desiree about her new album, Dreamy, which just came out. For the last few weeks, I have been teaching a course about Texas swing, rock and roll, soul, R&B, and hip-hop at Middle Tennessee State University. And Bob Wills was such a towering figure in the genre that has largely disappeared. We don't have a lot of Texas swing artists anymore, but the ones we have are pretty fabulous, and that includes Cheryl Desiree.
Hey guys, this is Cheryl Desiree, and I'm really excited to be here with you today to talk about my new album called Dreamy, which releases on September 7th. Dreamy is a playful, light, romantic, and at times even ethereal exploration of some of the many styles of swing music. From tunes inspired by the music of Bob Wills and Tennessee Ernie Ford to a smoky jazz ballad. From rollicking Dixieland to Django and Grappelli-style gypsy jazz. A classic jump blues duet with Ray Benson of Asleep at the Wheel and a sweet campfire western ballad featuring my friends The Riders in the Sky. That tune I co-wrote with Ranger Doug, and it's called Home to Stay. I even threw in a blue yodel, a twin fiddle country shuffle, and western-tinged bossa nova and Polynesian love songs for you. But today I want to talk about the song we're about to play called Sitting Duck. My goal for this tune was twofold. First, I wanted to tell the story of my courtship with my husband, Jeff Adams. Jeff co-produced this record with me, which we recorded mostly right here in Nashville, Tennessee, at Blackbird Studios in Berry Hill. Jeff is also the trombone player, or the duck, that you're going to hear quacking along in this fun little dance number. My other goal was to really show off my band, the Sugar Moon Swingers, and their excellence in playing a musical style of a bygone era, Western Swing. Western Swing is a really perfect blend of all of my favorite genres, traditional country, blues, and what is one of the truest forms of American roots music, jazz. I hope you really enjoy this record and that it inspires you to perhaps take a look backward and remember the great wealth and depth of our musical roots, for it is from them that our music will grow to nourish future sounds. I know that sounds cheesy, y'all, but I mean it from the bottom of my heart. Hope you like Dreamy. This is Cheryl Desiree, signing off.
Oh, hey, little guy. Where'd you come from? Story. Like this, sugar rushing with shadow. We dodged the crowds and we stayed out of sight. Chances hiding out, pressing our luck. Wild wind and a sitting duck. Little bit of danger on a night out of town. We drove the canyon with a rag top down. Scared excitement, little white lights. We were too sweethearts looking for an alibi. Smuggled love notes, stolen glances, new beginnings, second chances. Hiding out, pressing our luck. A wild wind and a sitting duck.
Americana Music News is a podcast produced by Sprinter Media, music by Dave Paulson, and you can reach us at amneditor@gmail.com.